Russia unexpectedly entered American politics this week when an open microphone at the Nuclear Security Summit in Seoul, South Korea, accidentally picked up U.S. President Barack Obama explaining to his Russian counterpart, Dmitry Medvedev, that it would be much easier to resolve the contentious issue of missile defense after the U.S. election.
My last election, please.
Yeah.
After my election, I have more flexibility.
I transmit this information to Vladimir and understand.
Russian presidential hopeful Mitt Romney, Obama's likely opponent in November, pounced on the exchange in an interview with CNN, suggesting that Obama was soft on Russia, which he called Washington's number one geopolitical foe.
Russia is not a friendly character on the world stage, and for this president to be looking for greater flexibility where he doesn't have to answer to the American people in his relations with Russia is very, very troubling, very alarming.
And that sparked a curt response from Medvedev, who told Romney that the Cold War was long over.
I would make at least two recommendations to all U.S. presidential candidates, including the one you just mentioned. First of all, they need to use reason and use their heads when they phrase their positions. Sometimes it doesn't harm a presidential candidate to do that. And secondly, check their watches from time to time, because it's 2012 now, not the mid-70s.
Friends, foes, partners, rivals. 2 decades after the end of the Cold War, how do Russians and Americans view each other, and what does it mean for the future of relations between Moscow and Washington? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
According to recent polls, about 60% of Americans have a positive attitude towards Russia, identifying it as either a friend or an ally. Just 30% call Russia an enemy. The low point in post-Cold War attitudes in America toward Russia came, not surprisingly, back in August 2008, during Russia's war with Georgia, when just 40% of Americans viewed Russia favorably, as opposed to 53% who had a negative opinion. Likewise, Russian attitudes towards the United States are surprisingly positive. According to a Levada Center poll conducted at the end of 2011, about 60% of Russians have a positive opinion of the United States. Kirill, I find both of these sets of statistics somewhat surprising, but especially the ones on the Russian side, given that anti-Americanism is very prevalent in the Russian mass media. What do you see going on here?
Well, first of all, I think that we are not discussing all Russian media. If we'll just note serious, so-called serious Russian newspapers like Kommersant or Ведомости or other some other things.
Is that a rule?
Yes. And even some TV channels. This attitude is not hostile. It's positive. It's positive. It's pragmatic and positive. So we are speaking only in this connection. We are speaking only about first and second federal, so-called federal channel. And or about some yellowish press.
Mm-hmm.
Not yellow, but yellowish press.
Yellowish.
No,
but polls also show that the vast majority of Russians not only get their news from television, but from state television, from the first channel and from NTV. And these channels, if according to my watching of them, have been, especially in the election season, extremely anti-American.
It shows the attitude of in general of the public to the official TV news and TV propaganda. First of all, of course, they listen to or watch official TV. NTV or First Channel or whatever, but they're thinking about filtering mm-hmm. the information, I think, in this case. And they just divide the information they really need to know, and the other information just like a rubbish or so on. So it's a majority of pragmatic, positive people who are the core of Russian society, as in any other so-called normal country.
So if that's the case, then why did the elite use the play the anti-American card or the anti-Western card, but the anti-American card so effectively during the campaign? I mean, I think from the moment Ambassador Michael McFaul landed in Moscow, there's been an information campaign against him that he is some secret mastermind of an orange revolution in Russia. You've had programs on NTV, the anatomy of a protest program that created so much controversy recently. Why did the authorities choose to go this route if, as you say, and the polls seem to suggest, the public just dismisses it?
I have two or three maybe points about this. First of all, I am very the efficiency of this anti-American propaganda and so on is very questionable, very dubious. As you see in this poll opinion data and so on, the attitude in general, the attitude toward America in Russia didn't change from the end of 1990s. So all this Putin's propaganda was absolutely ineffective in this sense.
These numbers have been steady.
Yes. First of all, why do they use this kind of propaganda? Not all the time. Yes, they're using this propaganda tool like anti-Americans and anti-Americanism and so on during some, as you told, some. Electoral campaigns or during some political crisis and so on. They prefer to play this game because of, and it's this is the most important point of all this discussion, I think, because of vacuum, ideological vacuum or lack of the ideology in modern Russian politics.
So anti-Americanism has become the ideology of the elite.
It's not the ideology of elite, but, you know, during the Soviet times, they had, or we had, a communist ideology, yes? And that was the basement of all the state, on all the communist party, on the politics, economics, and culture, yes? And now they don't have any ideology. It's no nationalism in the proper meaning of this term. It's not a communist, of course, because it's a capitalist country, right. Russia, and so on. So nothing, absolutely nothing. But you have to fill somehow this gap.
I mean, I've heard it argued that it's become great power imperialism. I've heard people argue that.
It's a kind of, I remember we discussed this problem 2 or 3 months ago. It's not a great country or great power imperialism, because modern Russian elite is very pragmatic. They don't think about the day after. They don't think about next week or next year. Well, they're doing what they need to do just now, and then we'll see what happens. And during the electoral campaigns, they need to mobilize somehow the electorate of theirs and to invent somehow the political content, the political agenda of electoral campaign, because they don't have any real content, real political content, all this official electoral campaign. They don't speak about real politics. They don't speak about real economics and so on. They have to speak about something. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they need something very sharp, very hot, and very popular.
But why does it work? Why does it work if the public doesn't believe it? This is the part where I'm having a little disconnect here.
But I told you that it doesn't work.
It doesn't work, but they use it in the election. To me, that sounds very odd, to use something that doesn't work. But judging from the results of the election, it might suggest that it did work. What's going on here between the elite and the population?
I think this anti-American campaign during the last electoral campaign didn't add any percent to the result. Absolutely, absolutely. At the same time, any other attempts to use, for instance, the macho image of Putin didn't add any women voice.
It certainly didn't add women voices according to the polls.
So don't forget about the total corruption in the government and around Kremlin. Of course, they invest a lot of money into this anti-American campaign and so on, and someone just steal it. Mm-hmm. It's, in Navalny words, распил и откат. That we're speaking about.
Yeah. Now, we've addressed the population, and there, as you've pointed out in the poll show, has been remarkably steady and generally positive towards the United States, despite all the twists and turns in Russian-American relations over the years. From the very warm relations we saw in the early 90s to the much more contentious relations we saw in the late 90s, specifically after the war with Kosovo and accelerating after Putin's election. We had a brief warming period in the early Putin period. Remember, Vladimir Putin was the first person to call George W. Bush after the September 11th attacks. And then we had, again, a cooling that climaxed with the Russian war with Georgia. And now we've had a warming trend under Obama and the reset in Medvedev. The public has stayed generally positive, with attitudes ranging between 50% and 60% positive towards the United States in this period. But the elite, has its opinion changed over this time? What's driving these changing relations?
Well, first of all, the elite plays its own game, its own political and especially economic game. So in this context, every random event, every random step in Russian-American relationships, we can discuss in a special terms, in a special context. Mm-hmm. For instance, when we're speaking about the Georgian conflict nearly four years ago, so that was a kind of combination of the interests of the those who support President Medvedev, newly elected, those who supported Putin, those who supported some kind of military elite in Russia, those who support some liberal but at the same time nationalistic circles, and so on. It was a very complex. It was a very complex, sophisticated game. And 4 years ago, not every today's liberal was against, for instance, a Russian invasion into Georgia. But now we see that the attitude towards America is positive, even among those who usually was very hostile to America. For instance, the leftist opposition. Mm-hmm. Udaltsov and so on. So we have to divide the situation into the games of the elites and the attitude, the general attitude of Russian population towards America. General attitude, it's more interesting because in some sense Russia, you can compare modern Russia and sometimes Russian history more likely to American history and American society than to European. Mm. Don't forget about it. What is the Russian history from 17th till 19th century? It's a history of colonization, of Siberia, expansion, colonization.
Continental expansion.
Yes. And usually that was the scarcely populated or wasted places. The same thing was in America.
Yeah, Manifest Destiny, the expansion across the North American continent.
Yes. Secondly, if we speak about the identity, a national identity of those who live in Siberia, for instance, and those who live in the United States, you can compare them because there are people who used to depend on themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is similar to the American West.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, I'm not speaking about Moscow and so on. I'm speaking about the population in Ural and there in Siberia.
In what we would call the heartland of the United States.
Yeah. From some point, I can even compare Krasnoyarsk and Krasnoyarsky region with California. Not in climate.
Definitely not in climate.
Yes, but it's the richest part of Russia. Excluding Moscow, of course, yes. And it's California with a lot of whatever, gas, oil,
gold
nickel, and so on. Secondly, if we speak about modern Russia, we see that usually so-called ordinary people live outside the area of the governmental or state influence. They usually depend on themselves, as in America. And that's why all this production of American pop culture, Hollywood and so on, are so popular in Russia. How can you explain this popularity in the other way?
Endless repetition of it in the media. But I mean, there's in other ways, the two countries are dramatically different. I mean, Americans are extremely individualistic. They are very anti-state in a lot of ways, and you can see this playing out in both political parties now. But where Russians tend to favor a more paternalistic state or a more
Last two generations.
Yes.
If we are speaking about the active part of Russian society, they're absolutely, I think, too individualistic, not in European way, because first of all, as I told you, they don't depend on the state and so on. But secondly, this is a kind of individualism which is the result of so-called atomization of the society. And in this case, we can compare this with the American situation.
Now, one thing I wanted to return to, another incident that took place this week, which was seen quite a bit on the Russian news, was Michael McFaul's confrontation with the journalists from NTV, who have been following him around ever. And again, as I said earlier, ever since Ambassador McFaul landed in Moscow, almost from the moment he landed, the media has been really, the state media has been really tough on him, accusing him of trying to foment some kind of a revolution. I found this odd for a number of reasons. First of all, from my understanding is the reason President Obama appointed Michael McFaul, who was in the White House as his chief Russia advisor, and I don't think he wanted to give him up and send him to Moscow, but that was to send somebody who was so close to the president to Moscow as ambassador. That's a signal to the Russian elite. We take this relationship very seriously. We're sending somebody who's very personally close to the president. We're sending somebody who speaks Russian, who knows the country, who lived in the country. And I was in Moscow in the 90s when Ambassador McFaul was working at the Carnegie Institute, and everybody in Moscow knew him as Mike. I mean, he's a lot of our colleagues too. Exactly. And I was a bit surprised, because when he was going through his confirmation hearings in the United States, the Republicans were concerned that he was going to be too soft. But the no sooner does his airplane land in Moscow than the I can call it nothing other than propaganda starts saying he's trying to foment some kind of a revolution. Now, America's going to pursue its interests in Russia like any country is going to pursue its interests. But nobody can reasonably look at the McFaul appointment and say this was an attempt to foment some kind of a revolution in Russia.
Sure.
The reasons for it were the reasons I just stated, to send a message to Moscow that we take this relationship seriously. Why the personal campaign against Ambassador McFaul? Why do you see that happening, given the context of what we were just saying about how generally the attitudes are more or less positive towards the United States and the population?
We're forgetting one very important thing about Russian elite, especially about Kremlin administration and all those who are tools of this administration. It's almost total ignorance of all these people in some fields. For instance, in the international international relationships. I think that most of them never heard the name of Michael McFaul, and they just tried to organize kind of dirty campaign about a new American ambassador, just whoever it will be, Michael McFaul or John Smith or whoever. Secondly, it was, don't forget about the moment when he was appointed. It was just before the elections, and everyone in Kremlin was absolutely anxious about what's going on and what will happen and so on. And let's try by chance to do something with this. As I told you, they're pragmatics. They cannot think strategically. They don't think about such kind of long-term relationships between United States and Russia. They're thinking about how to win these particular elections, and that's all.
Well, the way I've always thought about how this elite, and I think pragmatic is the correct word, the way I've always thought about how this elite approaches, I mean the Putin elite, the Putin team, how they approach America is, if they can, their goal is to keep themselves in power. That is their goal, to keep themselves in power, to keep their privilege, to be able to keep collecting rents from the oil industry and so on. And anything that furthers that goal is good, and anything that detracts from that goal is bad. And if you can achieve that goal of keeping yourself in power with good relations with America, then let's have good relations with America. If you can achieve that goal by spoiling relations with America and having bad relations with America, you can do it that way as well. And this, so I've come to the conclusion that it is in their interest right now to have bad relations. Would you agree with that? Or they've concluded that it's in their interest.
just add to what you said, one word, now. What is good now to reach their goal and so on? Just now, just today, not tomorrow or day after tomorrow and so on. Of course, strategically speaking, the natural ally of Putin's regime, and not regime itself, but some kind of pro-Putin circles in Russian economics and politics and so on, are American rights.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But somehow they made them absolutely hostile.
Yeah.
At the same time, naturally, President Obama and all his strategic course, it's not against this Putin regime and Putin people and so on, but it's not suitable for them, and in general terms, because it's not, of course, socialist or leftist or so
it's classic
American democratic way of thinking, yes, and the way how President Obama deal with some international problems like I don't know, Arab Spring and so on, it's a classic way of American democratic thinking, liberal thinking. It's absolutely opposing this pragmatic approach of Moscow.
Why? Both approaches are pragmatic.
No. Liberal way of thinking is not pragmatic. It's about the core values of liberal society. It's not a propaganda, kind of liberal propaganda and so on. It's just supporting the process which can finish or end up as a pro-democracy regimes, for instance, in some Egypt or Syria or whoever, whatever. And when we are speaking about Russian, for instance, Russian policy towards this Arab Spring and so on, we don't see any strategic course. We don't see this.
Let's hang on to your Soviet-era allies.
Yes.
They tried to hang on to Libya. They're trying to hang on to Syria.
They don't think even about what's going on there. They're trying to save their economic interests there. And that's all. But this is the thing which they usually accused United States of doing this. So it's kind of upside turn, yeah, all these values, because United States is trying to play, it's not ideological, but it's kind of sublime politics on Middle East or in China or whatever. And Russia plays pragmatically. And if you return to Russian-American relationships, it's the same thing. America's attitude, Obama's attitude to Russia, is moderate, pragmatic, and moderate ideological at the same time.
The policy has been spelled out by Ambassador McFaul and has been spelled out by others in the administration, Secretary Clinton, President Obama himself, is that it's a multi-track policy. America must engage Russia. Two countries of this size and importance in the world cannot not engage each other. They need each other to solve a lot of issues that only they can solve. But at the same time, and Michael McFaul very articulately argues this, that you can really help foster democracy and human rights when you are engaged with Russia.
Sure, sure.
It's much harder to do it when you're in opposition to each other. So this approach doesn't suit the current elite. They prefer a more confrontational approach that they think they would get.
Don't forget that it's not an ideological conflict as it was during the Cold War. It's not the ideological conflict. And it's very interesting because in some sense you have to find out some kind of field where the interests of United States and Russia can meet.
Well, yes. In two countries this large, their interests are going to inevitably bump into each other.
Yes, for sure.
Different points of,
for sure, as any other countries. So that's what we're speaking about. It's not a special relationships. It's kind of relationships between as many countries as United States and Russia, Great Britain and France, whatever, Poland and Hungary. So it's business as usual in the international relationship. And the Kremlin administration tried to substitute this for some kind of special hate campaigns or special, ideological fights or struggle and so on. But it's all in vain, absolutely. It doesn't exist. And the population, the Russian population, they instinctively, they understand this. That's why this positive attitude to America. We're returning to her first point, yeah.
And there's one more thing I wanted to do just very briefly before we move on to the next topic in today's discussion, is that the attempt to kind of demonize Russia that we saw from Mitt Romney fell pretty flat in the United States. It didn't really resonate at all. But on the other hand, the attempts to demonize the United States, they do resonate a little bit more, at least among the elite. Why this difference?
I am not sure that it's a very deep difference between two situations, because as we told about all this opinion poll data and so on, it's not effective. It's the efficiency of all this propaganda campaign is almost zero. That's why I'm thinking that in its foundation, Russian society has a positive attitude to America, and absolutely, I'm absolutely aware about this, and I'm sure it's for sure that it is so, because Russians, they live now in kind of it's funny, but they live in kind of a half American society. They are consuming American
products.
They are fans of American pop culture and so on. It's impossible to hate America in these conditions.
Well, this is what you call soft power.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kirill. In a few minutes, we're going to look at some other stories making headlines in Russia this week. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobudin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org or follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. The State Duma this week began considering legislation banning so-called gay propaganda. The bill calls for fines of up to 500,000 rubles, which is about $16,500, for spreading homosexual propaganda to minors, and up to 1 million rubles, or around $33,000, for promoting pedophilia. A similar law recently went into effect in St. Petersburg. Here's Vyacheslav Lysakov, a member of the Russian State Duma, speaking out in favor of that law.
I think that because children cannot protect themselves, the state has to do it for them. But there have to be clear criteria of how propaganda is defined and what kind of evidence there should be, whether it is a talk with a group of kids, distribution of literature, video clips. There should be clear definitions and clear criteria.
Rights activists have complained that the law, in effect, makes it illegal for gays to be open about their sexuality. They also take issue with the law's equivalence of homosexuality, which is becoming broadly accepted in the West, and pedophilia, which is universally reviled. Kirill, homosexuality was illegal in the Soviet Union, but it was decriminalized in Russia in 1993. What are the authorities trying to accomplish with this? What's going on here?
We already told today about the awful ignorance of some part of Russian political elite.
Is it just about that?
Yes, absolutely. Because if you are mentioned in the same law, so-called spreading homosexual propaganda and promoting pedophilia,
yeah,
and in this context, pedophilia is equal to homosexuality. It means that you understand absolutely nothing about all these things.
Right.
Yes, it's just rubbish. It's just idiotic attitude to all the things which are outside their own horizons of their narrow minds.
But it's already the law in St. Petersburg, Russia's second largest city, and it's about to be the law of the entire country.
It is very pity because, you know, St. Petersburg is named as the kind of cultural capital of Russia. What on earth is about culture in this legislation? It's a culture of hate. It's a culture of ignorance. It's a culture of illiteracy, political and legal illiteracy. And that's all.
But why? I mean, okay. Other than ignorance of these issues, why bring this up? Is there a problem in Russia with gay propaganda? I mean, really, what sparked this?
No.
Where did this come from?
First of all, they have to invent something to as a kind of substitute for the non-existing political agenda. So don't forget that there is no, and maybe there was no any real politics in Russia before the Duma elections or all this protest. They have to invent somehow this agenda to discuss it, to show it on TV screens and so on, and to increase their political capital on this. Don't forget about it. Because if you're speaking about, I don't know, United Russia, members of St. Petersburg Parliament or State Duma and so on, what on earth they are doing? Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
That's a good question.
No one knows about them. Even their names are absolutely obscure.
I know.
And if you are trying, so we want to introduce some kind of anti whatever law.
Mm-hmm.
What law? What is the most hated part of Russian population? Pedophiles.
Yeah, I think they're not just Russian population.
Yes,
probably any population.
Now it's another thing. I think that it's a kind of Western influence into Russian politics and society, because all this it's not hysteria, but it's a wide campaign against pedophilia. It began in Europe in connection with all the things with the Catholic Church and so on. It's not absolutely clear about this in Europe, even in Europe. But if you want to use this thing just to move the agenda of pedophilia into Russian politics, and if you don't understand, if you understand nothing about pedophilia, you understand nothing about whatever, whatever, excluding your own money and your own bribes and so on. So it's.
But no, I understand passing a law against pedophilia. Everybody can get behind.
Everyone
that,
will
I
support
think.
This. Yes.
So, but why mix it with homosexuality? Why do that?
Because they don't understand what's the difference between them.
They really don't understand
I'm
the difference.
I'm absolutely sure that most of them absolutely don't understand what's going on in both cases.
That's amazing. I'm curious to actually to see how this is received in society. And to be fair, it wasn't that long ago when homosexuality was illegal in a lot of American states, okay? Until the Supreme Court ruling in the early part of the past decade, Lawrence versus Texas, I believe, in 2003. Homosexuality was illegal in a lot of southern states. And now, once that law was passed, things changed very quickly and things changed very dramatically. Two things happened. Gay marriage passed, or civil unions, or both passed in a lot of American states. About half the states now have one or the other. And the attitudes of ordinary Americans toward homosexuality became dramatically more tolerant. Now, I'm not saying that Supreme Court ruling alone did it, but that was the beginning of a process. But it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't even 10 years ago. So I guess my question to you is, how do Russians view homosexuality today? Because in the West, discrimination against homosexuality is no different than discrimination against somebody based on their race or their gender. Now, the attitudes have changed dramatically, and in Europe as well. How do Russians view homosexuality today? Is it viewed negatively? Does this ignorance you talk about in the elite, does this extend to society?
Let's return to the roots and the difference between the roots of this anti-gay legislation and attitude in Western society, especially in the United States and in Russia. In the United States, it's based on Christian values.
Yes.
And that is
largely.
And that is the answer. In Russia, in modern, in Europe, it was based on, first of all, in Christian values. Don't forget, for instance, in Great Britain, where the Anglican Church is a state church.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That is the reason of all these things that happened with tuning and so mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. That is the answer. What about Russia? Russia is not a Christian society. The influence of Russian Orthodox Church on Russian society is absolutely overrated.
Their influence on politics is enormous, though.
No, it's just propaganda. No. The root of this anti-gay attitude in Russia, of course, lays on the foundation of the machist late Soviet culture, criminal culture. That is the explanation of what's going on.
Can you explain that a little more?
Yes, for sure. If we return to the beginning of the Soviet Union, the Soviet period of history, 1920s, before the Stalin's rising to the power, we can say that 1920s was the decade of the various experiments in politics, in economics, of course, in culture, Russian avant-garde, and so on.
So you're talking about the NEP period.
Yes, it was NEP period and so on, and even in various public and moral values and so on, about family and so on. And the total attitude to homosexuality in
this period,
the 20s. Yes, in 20s was not bad totally. Maybe it was toward feminist movement. Mm-hmm. It was maybe in some sense better than it was in Western society. Mm-hmm. But then that was the returning of so-called state imperialistic Russian Empire ideology.
With the rise of Stalin.
Yes, the rise of Stalin. And with this and with all these repressions and Gulag and so on, is returning the machist
macho
ideology, maybe in some sense, and mixing with this criminal roots of a lot of things in the Soviet society, because of the half of population went through the prisons and camps and so on, and all these things they form the total negative attitude to homosexuality in the 1960s and 1970s. Don't forget all, let's remember all this pop culture and culture heroes of liberal Soviet circles in 1970s. For instance, Vladimir Vysotsky.
Mm-hmm.
He's a real macho.
Yeah.
He's a real macho. You can't even remember just one or two famous artists or actors or whoever who was gay.
Mm-hmm.
Not openly, but just...
Not openly.
Yes. The only story with this was with Sergei Parajanov,
mm-hmm.
who went to prison, because of this law. And today, all this attitude to homosexuality, all this total ignorance in all this very important, not just gender or sexual, or it's a social problem. They even don't understand how sophisticated all these things is about, yeah?
So essentially, you're saying that the communists and the Soviet Union changed from an avant-garde movement when they were, of course, in opposition, when they came to power, and they were avant-garde in things sexual, artistic.
Yes, for sure, because it was just after the revolution.
And then it conservatized.
Yes, the Russian Empire was very traditional society.
So it was the Russian Thermidor was what's to blame for this. What do they mean by gay propaganda?
Speaking frankly, I don't understand.
Because you have to wonder if this makes it illegal to be gay, or at least to admit one's homosexuality.
Or to play Tchaikovsky symphonies. To play The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde.
Right.
Or to whatever.
No, it'll be interesting to see where this all goes. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org or follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. And now I leave you with the music of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.